Everyone on the board is here for one reason and one reason only.
To protect the king.
That is right. To protect the king. Now, he is old and has survived many battles, so he can only move one spot at a time.
So who's got his back if he can only move one spot?
The queen. Now, she is smarter, faster, and stronger than her king. The knight is the horse. Now, he can move two spots forward and one spot to the side. The trusty bishop is his diagonal attack. The rook, he patrols the entire board. He can move as many spaces as he wants as long as it's in the same direction he was moving. Ah, yes, the pawns. They are the front line. They will be casualties.
You are listening to The Sill with Peter Noce and Harry Posner.
Come on in, have a seat.
Join the conversation.
Welcome to The Sill podcast. My name is Harry Posner, and I'm here with co-host Peter Noce. Our guest today on the show is actually a neighbor of mine, living with his wife only a few hours away in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. But we have more in common than that. Kyle Creamer, like myself, when in his early 20s, fell in love with the game of chess and chose to dive into the deep end of that fascinating pool. Now, Kyle is a Canadian game developer and author. He has been a lifelong fan of fantasy and science fiction books and started writing his first short stories when he was 13 as a way to entertain his little brothers. My Chess Memoir is Kyle's first published book and tells the story of his journey into the world of competitive chess. Kyle, welcome to the Sill podcast.
Hi, Kyle.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Really excited to talk a little bit of chess and feeling fantastic.
Awesome. First of all, Kyle, I just wanted to say your book was a great read. It really was.
Thank you.
It actually reads a bit like a thriller as you lay out your journey into and eventually out of the world of competitive chess over a period of several years. And in many ways, it echoes the chess journey of my younger years as well. I was into chess in my 20s, playing competitively, etc. So very interesting conjunction of souls here. What compelled you to write this book?
Well, you say that it reads a little bit like a thriller, and living that experience, it almost felt that way as well. Really, I got into chess and I just felt like it was this important, exciting, dramatic experience. But then after I sort of didn't play as much chess afterwards, I found myself unable to really explain to people like how meaningful and dramatic some of these things were, because to explain the drama of a chess game, like for people who don't play chess, it almost might sound a little bit silly. Like, aren't you guys just sitting at the board for 4 hours thinking, like, isn't this the most boring thing in the world? But it's very much not. It's very dramatic and very exciting. And so I really just wanted to convey that side of things, the competitive highs and lows, and also just share some of the stories of all these wonderful people that I met. There's so many smart, unique, creative people in the world of chess. It's almost like watching the most entertaining TV show you've ever seen, meeting some of the people that play chess. Mm. And so I also wanted to sort of share the stories of all these interesting people that I'd met. Mm-hmm. So really just to share that story, I just felt like I had to distill it down into a format that even non-chess players could read and understand. So that's really what drove me to write the book in the first place.
Cool.
So given that you were so intrigued with video games in your younger years, what actually made you take up chess as your game of choice?
Yeah, it was a little bit of almost like a weird coincidence or kind of an unusual start. I talk about it a bit in the book, but I was actually watching a TV show that I really loved called Survivor, for those who watch that. And someone was pretending to be a chess grandmaster while they were playing the show Survivor. And I was sort of like, oh, interesting, chess grandmaster. I've heard that term before, but what does that even really mean? And it just kind of led me down this rabbit hole of learning about what it takes to become a grandmaster and how to improve at chess if you really want to study it rigorously. And I do think once I got into chess, some of the overlap with video games is what kept me hooked, because I love puzzle games, which probably would be no surprise. And just the logic of solving chess puzzles or trying to reason out the best move, it felt like solving a puzzle in a video game. So those two worlds were a natural overlap, and actually vice versa as well. My time in chess has actually influenced a lot of my game design afterwards, where I try to capture the feeling of solving a really hard chess puzzle in some of my games. So it's kind of a symbiotic relationship there.
Makes sense.
Right. And the book, as I read it, is this really interesting journey, and it kind of chronicles your trajectory, let's say, towards eventually becoming a grandmaster. And let me ask you this, what would that achievement have meant for you had you gotten there?
When I was a kid, I always idolized like sports heroes. I was a football fan growing up, so I was a big fan of like, oh, the quarterbacks that win the Super Bowl, or really successful business people that founded these big companies at a young age. Oh, Mark Zuckerberg founded Facebook. And there's all these articles written about him. And really, I feel like part of the inner motivation for me, at least, was when I read these articles about these successful people, to me, that was the ultimate thing to achieve. That was like the ultimate validation, to have people recognize your success. And so really what was driving me to become a grandmaster was a little bit of that almost, where I wanted that sort of validation, like, hey, he achieved this. He really earned this and was able to reach that pinnacle. So I really feel like that was a big part of what was driving me, was just this kind of inner drive to get that, I guess, recognition or validation, which it's a lot more clear after the fact. But I think that was really a lot of where that came from.
So for those listening who may not be aware of or understand the stress of playing competitive chess, can you draw me a picture of the kind of mental flow that can happen during a back and forth tournament game?
Yes, absolutely. It is an intense experience. Just for context, you can play games of chess with different, they call them time controls, and it's basically how much time you're allowed to think for. So you can play speed chess, which is very fast. You only have 5 minutes of thinking time for the entire game. But Harry and I also play long, they call it classical time control, in competitive tournaments where you have 2 hours per person of thinking time for each game. So that's a long game of chess, like I was saying earlier. That could be a 4-hour game. And it is really intense, because to put that much careful thought into your moves, you really do need to check every little thing. Okay, I want to move my knight to this square. I'm trying to figure out what my opponent's going to be doing. And you need to really be so careful. When someone's sitting there and their mind is racing, they're thinking for 10, 20, 30 minutes on even a single move, really a lot of it is just trying to be so careful that you're not going to accidentally put your piece on a square where 3 or 5 moves from now, oh no, it's going to fall into some sort of trap. So you're trying to be so careful. You're trying to clearly visualize things ahead of time, because it's very common in chess where you think for a long time about a move, play your move, and then immediately realize, oh my God, 2 moves from now, he's going to be able to do this, this, and now I'm going to lose the game. So it's very trying to always prevent mistakes and be very vigilant. And that is very stressful, because even still, you're looking for these mistakes, you're trying to be so careful, and then you still make that, in chess we call it a blunder, when you make a mistake that loses a piece. So you think about a move for so long and you still sometimes end up blundering. So it's very, you know, it's like teetering on a knife's edge, you know, as you think so carefully.
Yeah, I've been there, believe me.
Yeah, exactly. Harry knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I've been there for sure, for sure.
Sounds a bit like daily living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I was sitting in a chair, not moving a muscle, but I could feel my heart pounding in my chest. In front of me was a chessboard. Upon its surface were 2 armies, the white and black pieces. To the side of the board was a clock that measured and limited our thinking time, a constraint for the generals that commanded and maneuvered the pieces. And across the board sat my opponent, my enemy, the person whose sole objective was to outthink and destroy me. It was the final round of a competitive chess tournament, and we were the last 2 people still playing. The tension in the air was so thick, I dared not even shift in my seat. I had just made a move, and now I awaited my opponent's response. My shirt was damp with sweat. My face was red hot from the stress of relentless mental exertion. At some moments, I wanted to forfeit the game and walk out. Anything to escape the overwhelming tension. More than a dozen people had crowded around the board, watching intently as my opponent and I continued to battle. The scrutiny was severe. After my move, I felt like I could hear each person around us thinking, "Why did you do that?" I examined the board once more, trying to visualize what the configuration of pieces would look like after my opponent's next move and my move after that. Any detail that I overlooked could be fatal. My head was foggy from exhaustion, but I refused to be the one to make the final mistake.
To me, it takes a certain kind of person to be willing to sit there under that kind of stress and angst for hours on end, staring across the board at someone who's also in that state, probably. And I was in a car the other day with a bunch of chess players heading down to Lunenburg for a tournament, and the conversation came around of what are chess players like in general? And the common denominator that we came to was that they're weirdos. We're weirdos. And so I'm going to ask you, do you think, Kyle, there's a kind of type connected to those who love chess?
I mean, maybe not everybody, of course, to speak in too general of a term, but I think there is a little bit of a type. And I take that very much as a compliment, because when you're saying that, like, it rings true to me. Me and my chess friends, it's sort of the way you say, hey, I'm a nerd, but it's like, I mean it in a good way. I feel the chess players almost universally would say, hey, chess players are weirdos. And they would be like, yep. And they'd say it with a smile on their face. But I don't know. That's part of what drove me to want to make the book, because we are kind of weirdos in that way. It's such an eclectic group of different careers and hobbies. And I've met many chess players that are into like really weird music, or maybe one trait, especially for competitive chess players, is we can tend to be a little bit obsessive. Anybody who's going to sit and play two classical games of chess a day for a whole weekend or longer, you got to be a little bit obsessed. There's a lot of chess players I know that kind of have that. They get fixated on like a hobby or something they love, and they go really deep into it. A good friend of mine who plays chess in Nova Scotia here is a competitive video game player as well. And he grinded and grinded and became one of the very best in the world at that. And then he grinded and grinded and became one of the best chess players in our community. Chris Felix is the guy I'm talking about. I'm not sure if you had met him, Harry, but
yeah, I have. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And I think maybe a little bit of obsessive pursuit of the things they love. And maybe that is a characteristic of weirdos, as we say.
Well, I haven't had the experience that both of you have had. I've dabbled in chess a little bit in my university years, and I've only played like a half a dozen games, but I have to say that I was pretty intrigued with it all. And just the name chess, I have so many associations with it, a lot of it delving back to the medieval days, the knights, the military aspect of the game, the strategy. And so what is it about chess, do you think, that so many people around the world are compellingly drawn to?
Yeah, there's so many angles to it. That discussion almost could fill a podcast, but I'll just briefly, I think part of it is from a game design standpoint, it's kind of the dream thing that as a game designer you want to come up with, which is it is relatively simple rules, but extremely complicated sort of playing space. It's not that hard to learn how the pieces move, but it's extremely, extremely hard to get good at chess and see all the possibilities. So there's a certain elegance in that where I can pretty quickly in an hour learn how to play chess, but then mastering it is really challenging. That's another way of saying it is easy to learn, difficult to master. Mm-hmm. Like that's the characteristic of a lot of really great games. So I do feel that is part of it. But even just culturally, I think that the very pieces are attractive in some way where the pieces look fun. It's a castle, it's a horse. I feel even the art of the piece crafting itself draws people to the game a little bit. I mean, checkers is a more simple game anyway, but I feel like just the little checker pieces, there's something that chess does inspire with its unique pieces that other games don't. So I think it's kind of a combination of those things, of it's just a really well-designed game, and there's just some beauty about how fun the pieces seem. And then just the only other quick thing I'd add is I do feel you're right that culturally chess kind of has this attachment with intelligence or sophistication or being a mastermind. And so I do feel there's almost a little bit of, hey, I want to play chess because I kind of want to be that, feel that. So it's a combination of all these things. It's some sort of beautiful mixture.
Mm-hmm. I'll say a couple of things to that. First off, the game itself, as you mentioned, the pieces were definitely a draw for me, even seeing them constructed in various shapes and sizes and colors, because a lot of artists and a lot of creators have made chess pieces, some of them even life-size on a board in a museum, whatever. But the thing to me with chess is also, as you mentioned, it's associated with a level of thinking, a level of digging deep into something. And in fact, there's a movie that was based on a true story titled Life of a King, and it starred Cuba Gooding Jr., and he plays chess teacher Eugene Brown. And Brown, in real life, spent time in prison, mentored by a prisoner named the Chess Man. And he taught him to love the game of kings. And the whole thing is predicated on also helping youth, in this particular case, or prisoners, to find a method or a way of rehabilitating or finding a love of something to do that focuses their attention. And it's based on, and we said this earlier, or at least I said it, in association with daily living, it's predicated on basically thinking before you move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to jump in, I have not seen that movie. I have heard of it. And I feel like a bit of a bad chess fan for having not seen it. You know, I feel like Harry and I, we should have seen all the chess movies by this point, I think.
We should have. Well, of course. And the other chess movie that really sparked a lot of interest in chess was The Queen's Gambit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%.
Came out a couple of years ago and really sparked a bit of an upswing in interest in the game. But let me just get back to your book for a second, Kyle. You lay out your journey and you take us through tournament after tournament, and your rating is kind of moving up and moving down a little bit. And then you're excited when it's moving up and you're kind of depressed when it's moving down. And all of this in aid of your trajectory towards becoming a chess grandmaster. Now, there was a point in the book, and maybe you could help me pinpoint it, where you kind of realized that that was not going to be happening as quickly as you liked or in the way that you had imagined it. Can you talk a bit about that moment?
Yes, absolutely. I don't want to spoil the book too much, but certainly at the beginning, I think that as I got into chess, it's very rewarding. You have a numerical rating attached to your skill level, basically. And as you're saying, it goes up and down. Depending on if you win games, it goes up. You lose games, it goes down. And so it's a very honest reflection of how you're doing. And certainly at the very beginning of my journey, I saw myself, my rating was going up, and it's very rewarding and it's so exciting. And then certainly as you face tougher and tougher competition, it becomes harder and harder to climb. And I do think maybe this is true for a lot of things, but to be a beginner at something versus as you become more intermediate and advanced, the nature of how you improve can sometimes change as well. What it takes to learn how to program a basic website is very different from what it takes to become like a really strong professional web developer. It becomes a lot tougher to improve your skills, and the number of things you need to be able to master at any one time is a lot broader. So certainly I definitely in the book run into a point where, yeah, I'm starting to bump into that tension of, hey, it's a lot harder to improve now. And it really is like a moment of, when you hit adversity like that, it causes you to look inward, I think. And certainly I would have a really tough loss and I'd be laying there at night and I would just be thinking to myself, why am I doing this? You know, it really makes you question your drive for something and makes you ask yourself, you know, how bad do I want this? And that's a big part of the book is when you hit these tough moments, how do you respond to that? And what should you respond to that? Your brain might think, okay, just pick yourself back up, never give up. Part of what I discuss in the book is, what are you willing to pay or what are you willing to give up in order to keep picking yourself back up? Because it's easy to say, hey, I'll put more time in and I'll train more and I'll just put in more hours. But we all have 24 hours in the day, and every hour you're putting into chess or whatever it is you're pursuing, that's an hour you're taking away from something else, maybe your friends or your family or your whatever. So That, I think, is one of the big lessons I learned in this book. Is trying to understand the trade-off of, if you want to be excellent at something, there is very much a cost to that. And you got to be really willing to pay that. And maybe it's not the right thing for you to choose to pay that, depending on what you value in life. So that's a big part of what I got out of this experience and what I talk about in the book.
And just to continue with that, because hey, I'm going to go back to the word, Harry's going to laugh when I say this, what you're talking about, this finding that happy balance, because it's something I always go to in the podcast. Harry knows that.
Sure.
It's the same thing here. Essentially, you're talking about where is that line? So when did you first realize that your obsession could be understood also as an addiction in some cases when it came to your attraction to the game of chess?
Yeah, there were certainly signs along the way, I think, and I certainly try to hint at those in the book, but I think there were signs along the way. I mentioned in the book, my brother, for example, who I was living with at the time, I'm very close with, he would say like, hey, you know, it's Sunday night. Do you want to go watch a football game? And I'd say, oh, I really got to practice my chess puzzles or study this opening. And so there were subtle signs, I think, along the way of it's fine one Sunday if you want to practice chess, but if it becomes most Sundays or every Sunday, and all of a sudden it's like, I'm never watching football with my brother. It starts to creep in. But then I think especially as I continue to reach that sort of ceiling of what my skill is in chess, it became harder because now I'm feeling like, oh, I need to do this basically full time if I really want to improve, because anything less, I'm not seeing the results I'm hoping for. And so you start to, you know, I'm on my phone trying to study chess at work. You start to see it creep more into your life and you kind of realize, oh boy, I don't know if this is good for me. It's like you have a really bad chess tournament and then you're cranky with your family. And it just, It really permeates all the different parts of your life. And you start to realize, why am I letting this have such an effect? But you do start to notice that it really affects everything at a certain point, the more kind of obsessed I got, at least.
Yeah. Who's in control? Am I in control of chess or is chess in control of me?
Yeah.
100%. I've definitely had many, many days where I felt chess was in control of me. It sounds almost funny, like a little bit, to hear it without knowing the story. You feel like you're addicted to chess. That doesn't sound so bad, but I can tell you it's not fun to be addicted to anything if it is what's controlling you.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's a whole world of talk these days around the idea of gaming addiction in particular. It's become known as a thing in itself, a dis-ease, if you like, or something that people need to work through as an addiction. And although the science around addiction, I was just looking into it recently, is kind of complicated. It's sort of unclear. There's no definitive sense of what an addictive personality is, let's say. But when you look at your own life, Kyle, and your movement through this chess world, would you say that you have something of an addictive personality?
I think a little bit. And I think that kind of goes back to what we were saying about chess players, at least in my experience. I do think a lot of chess players can be a little bit obsessive. I think I certainly fit that bill. When I was in school, I would be really obsessed about getting A+ on every test. When I would play video games, I would want to have the best score. So I do think I lean towards a little bit of that obsessive personality or addictive personality. Mm-hmm. And I think chess aligned with that as well, because I think some people get maybe a little bit obsessive with chess and it's fine because that's the thing they love the most. And I do think part of the problem is compounded when it's, hey, I'm obsessive over this one thing, but there's other things that I really care about. I use the example in the book. Now I have written this book and published it, but at the time I'd never released a book and I always wanted to. That was like a big dream of mine. And so that's just one simple example of being obsessive with chess was coming at the expense of sitting down and writing a book. Now, I guess maybe it all worked out in the end because I wrote a book about chess, but it's an example of the obsessive personality. I feel like it stings, especially when you feel it taking away from something else that you want to be doing. So that was part of the mental anguish that I was going through in the later part of my chess career.
Mm-hmm. Well, in part, you've sort of answered the question I'm going to ask you now, which is always one of my favorite questions when doing interviews with people. What have you learned? What are some of the things you've learned about yourself or others from this journey into and out of the world of competitive chess?
Certainly, it was a huge learning experience in many ways. And I think this actually touches a little bit on what you were saying earlier about the chess movie and the focus on teaching chess to youth and things, because I do feel the lessons I learned from chess were really helpful. And I think that this is a helpful thing just in general for people to learn. It certainly taught me how to be humble and be a good loser. When you go to a chess club and you're the easily worst player out of the 15 people that show up every week, that is a humbling experience, and it teaches you how to lose with grace and treat it as a learning experience. Hey, wow, you really beat me pretty good in that game. Like, could we go over the moves? That's one thing chess players are really great about is I've always felt a lot of camaraderie, I guess, or this sense of helpfulness where, okay, hey, I beat you at this chess game, but let's go now recap our game. And if I was the one that defeated you, I will give you some advice on the kinds of things that I was looking for that let me defeat you. And here's what you might improve for next time. So that sense of learning from people that are better than you and losing with grace, I think, is a big lesson. I think it also taught me a lot about just diligent work habits and developing a regimented sort of study program. Although I probably went a little too far in the deep end on my chess study at some point, it was a helpful skill to learn the process of getting better at something. The process of being a beginner and learning the list of things you need to do to improve, and then actually putting time on your calendar and sitting down and solving chess puzzles and then seeing my improvement. That process, I feel like, generalizes to a lot of different things in life. So I was glad to have learned it. Kind of the skill at getting good at something, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I feel I kind of learned that for the first time in chess.
Makes perfect sense and sort of a confidence builder too, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So.
Also, I'm not sure if there have been studies made about this, but I'm 73 now and I'm playing chess and playing competitive chess as well. And I have this very strong feeling that playing the game of chess is really good for one's brain, if you like, as one gets older, to keep the muscles working and to stave off dementia and that sort of thing. I'm not sure if there are studies, but I have this very strong sense that it really does help to play chess as you get older.
Yeah, someone smarter at the science than I am can probably weigh in more accurately. But I know that certainly just anecdotally, I feel that way. I mean, chess feels like hard work for your brain. And I feel like anything that is hard work for your brain, if you kind of use the analogy, the brain is a muscle, like using it helps strengthen it. But I do feel like even here in Nova Scotia, we had a wonderful event a couple of summers ago called Pawnwise.
Yep.
And it was this big chess festival and celebration. And it was actually all around the theme of the role of chess in healthy aging. And I believe there was a professor that came in to speak about that at this event. So shout out to the folks that organized that. That was a really special and cool event. I'm not the expert in the science, but it certainly feels that way. And I'm only 34 and it feels like it's good for my brain. And chess and its role in healthy aging, I feel like, is a really interesting topic.
Mm-hmm. And what are your hopes for this book, Kyle? What do you want people to take away from it?
Well, I think it's a mix depending on who you are as a reader. For folks that are chess players, that's great. I feel like they'll feel seen a little bit of, hey, I saw similar things happen in my chess journey. And so that's one slice of the audience that I hope to reach is just other chess players and having them feel like, aha, yes, I see so much in common with your journey as I saw in my journey. But actually much more broadly than that, and kind of goes back to the reason I wrote the book, this book is very much written for a non-chess audience as well. You do not need to be a chess player to read the book. It's very much focused on the narrative. And I'm just excited to give people a glimpse into the world of chess and showcase some of the really interesting people that I met. It just, even in the moment, felt like such a story that I was living with this cast of interesting characters. So I do hope that for folks who are not a chess player who might think, oh, it's a chess book, like I can't read it, give it a chance because it's really written with that person in mind. And I really hope that it gives people a glimpse into the world of chess and also to shine a light on some of the learnings that I had from chess, like I was talking about previously. Some of those lessons I got from chess, they're not chess specific lessons. Being humble and learning from people that are better than you and being a good loser. These are hard lessons, but they're applicable to all of life, not just chess. So I really, it's those two sort of audiences in mind.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the book itself, my chess memoir is a self-published book. Do you have any advice for writers who want to self-publish?
I'm trying to think of advice I would have given myself. I wrote the first draft of this in 2017, and I finished it in 2018. And then I only just released the final self-published book for people to read in 2024. So the first advice I would give myself is don't spend 6 years editing it. I think there's a little bit of There's a little bit of don't let perfect be the enemy of done, or whatever that quote is. Mm-hmm. You know, you definitely want to do a good job and be proud of the product that you have. But I spent a lot of nights agonizing over how are people going to interpret this part, or, oh, I got to rewrite this, or a little bit of maybe that obsessive personality popping up again of with any artistic thing. It's hard to release it. But I do wish I'd maybe been a little bit less of a perfectionist around it. But be smart about when your thing feels done to you. It doesn't have to be perfect, perfect, perfect. You want it to be high quality, but it does not have to be 100% perfect before you release something. The other thing, I mean, I know a lot of folks struggle with finishing. The first draft is almost the hard part of like, well, how do I finish a book? I actually, it's kind of a cute thing, but I started writing this and I sketched the outline for the book and I kind of had a sense of what each chapter was going to include. But the actual motivation for continuing to write and finish the actual content of the book really came from my mom. Because when I wrote the first chapter, I sent it to her over email and she wrote back. It's like, oh, this was so interesting. And here's my notes. And then the next week I sent her a second chapter. And then before long, now every Sunday night, she was expecting a new chapter in her inbox. Mm. And that was a shockingly powerful motivator, because when just the simple act of my mom was expecting a chapter to be done. So, hey, Kyle, you better finish that chapter this week. That was very motivating. So I don't know how people can recreate that in their lives. If it's a friend or a family member, or just some sort of, I guess, deadline in that way. But that was very motivating to me and really helped me get over the finish line of finishing the book. I think a lot of books, you might write 6 or 7 chapters and it's hard to keep pushing through to the end. So that was really helpful for me just in terms of actually finishing the book.
You're right, Kyle. Just to add on to what you're saying about self-publishing, obviously the journey doesn't stop with the publishing of the book, because being self-published means you have to take on the onerous task of getting it out into the world and doing publicity and finding places where you can spread the word. How is that going?
Yeah, it's been a unique challenge for sure. You are right that the work does not stop. It's fun. It's a lot more fun, I will say, to do the promoting of the book, at least for me, than it was the editing process, which was a lot of work that felt like work. Promoting the book, it's almost this celebration. You get to talk about it as a finished product and you don't have to stress anymore about like, oh, am I going to cut that passage from chapter 12 or not? So I find it's definitely work. And it's actually, I'm not the most skilled person at that side of things. My forte is in the writing of the book, I think, not in the promoting of the book. So I've been enjoying it. I don't know if I'm successful at that part of it yet, the marketing and the promotion, but it has been fun, I will say. So it's definitely work, but I've enjoyed it. I guess time will tell if I'm any good at it.
Where can people get the book, or how can they purchase it?
Yeah, so you can get it online. The best place for Canadian listeners is actually on the Barnes & Noble website or the Indigo Chapters website. And so if you go to either of those, you can just search My Chess Memoir. You can get it in paperback. You can get it in hardcover. And there's also an ebook, which is in Canadian dollars. It's $5 for the ebook. So that's a nice cheaper option. Mm-hmm. It's $20 for the paperback and $30 for the hardcover. And then it's also available on Amazon.com, but that's a little more optimized for the international and U.S. audience.
Yeah, and this is probably a good time for you to mention your website.
Yes, 100%. I also have a website with all of the details about the book and links to all the places you can purchase it. It's KyleCremerAuthor.com. So that's a nice one-stop sort of place to go to learn more about the book and to find all the purchase links. I'm glad you brought that up, Peter. This is a testament to I'm still learning the promotion side of things, because that should probably be the first thing I bring up. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Okay. You already have a fairly good knowledge, a technical knowledge of computers and so on, and creating things on your computer for the purposes of publication and promotion. But a lot of people who aren't familiar with that, how much of a daunting task is it to do things in preparation for all these things that we've talked about?
Yeah, there's certainly work that goes into it. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit biased because, as you say, my background is in computers. And so I'm pretty comfortable with that side of things. But trying to take myself out of my own bias, I feel like the bigger problems were a lot more creative and artistic, even with getting the book done. The actual getting the files set up and all of that, like the sort of technical side of getting the book out there. The nice thing about the age we live in is it's there's lots of resources you can use that are very step by step. So that part I found not so daunting, but the questions of who am I going to work with to edit my book, or what's my cover going to look like, or what's my website going to look like? The artistic, I want to make this look good, I found much, much more challenging than the technical, how do I get this website live, or how do I upload this manuscript? And even with the promotion of the book, I think that that's the same thing. Like, it's a lot more of who do I reach out to, or what do I want to post on Facebook or social media to trying to come up with interesting content. To me, that was by far the bigger challenge rather than any of the necessarily technical side of things. So you definitely have to figure out the technical side of things. But I found that that was a lot more like you find a good guide, you follow it, you know the answer, you just need to spend the time to do it. But the actual, like, what does my book look like, or what should I do to promote it? There's no step-by-step guide for here's the right answer. So that I found a lot more challenging. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And I think that'll be very helpful to many people. So I guess just to wrap things up here, first of all, I've really enjoyed hearing your answers, talking to you. And of course, I had the opportunity to talk to you before we did this podcast. I was impressed with the book. I was impressed with everything surrounding it as well. And I'm glad that Harry put me on to you and that the two of you know each other, and been really a pleasure talking to you here today.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's really so much fun to talk about the book. And thank you for having me. And thank you for all the great questions. This was a blast.
And looking forward to facing you across the chessboard, Kyle. I'm sure it's going to happen soon enough. And it's going to be C4 for you.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Speaking of learning things from people that are better than you, for the listeners, I got to see Harry play at the most recent tournament here in Nova Scotia. And I'm now officially scared. He did really well. So I think there will be a lesson in store for me whenever that day comes, Harry.
Let's hope so. Thanks, yeah. Kyle. Much appreciated. Great talking to you.
Yeah. You as well. Thanks so much.
Take care, Kyle.
Bye-bye.
The Sill is a Connecting Dots Media production, available at thesillpodcast.com.
Thank you for your donation to The Sill Podcast.